Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Welcome to the show. It's brought to you by The Athletic along with The Square Ball. I'm Dan from The Square Ball. Michael is here as well, along with Phil Hay from The Athletic. We're twice a week now, Mondays and Fridays. This is the Friday edition. Now, normally we would do it straight after the press conference, but with the turnaround this week of the midweek game and the Spurs game being on Saturday, we're recording ahead of Jesse Marsh's press conference at Thorpe Arch. However, we will be previewing the Spurs game in due course. We're going to reflect on Wolves, talk about the takeover stuff. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod to read Phil's stuff on the website. Pound a month for 6 months. That's TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod. And just to give you a quick heads up as well, hang around at the end of this show to hear a taster of Away From Home, which is The Athletic's new documentary series. It's an access all areas thing with Ukrainian team Shakhtar Donetsk. A fantastic listen. And final bit of information to convey is that we are taking a break after Monday's post-Spurs show. We're going to come back just after the World Cup, just before the season resumes, just before Christmas. Unless something happens in the meantime, Phil, we will talk about takeovers in between times, won't we? So we'll get to all that. Should we start with Wolves? You went. How was it for you?
It was an enjoyable evening, actually. Enjoyable game to watch and a bit of intrigue in it because of the lineup that Jesse Marsh picked. It was quite difficult from the reaction to the team to work out if people were pleased to see the under-21s involved in the way they were or if people would have liked a stronger lineup or potentially a stronger squad. I think even more notable than the kind of understrength team or how young the lineup was, certainly the front six that Marsh went with, was how young the bench was. I mean, it was one of those nights where a lot of people in the press box were saying to me, who's this? You know, who are these people? So, you know, scrambling for Google to find out a little bit about the sort of wider reaches of the under-21 squad. I suspect people coming from the Leeds area will relate to this when I say that pound for pound, Wolves is the worst drive in the country. I don't know what it is about it. I think when you go to the South Coast, you kind of get it in your head that you are going to be on the road for 3 hours, 3.5 hours, 4 hours. But Wolves doesn't feel that far. It doesn't look particularly long distance on the map. And it somehow seems to be one of these grounds that isn't just a couple of motorways and then fight through a short bit of town. But anyway, we made it. We made it for kickoff, which was great. I thought Leeds played okay last night. I thought they played pretty well. I thought they were in the game, competitive. I thought most of the youngsters, certainly the debutants who played, did as well as they wanted to have done without being perfect. I really liked the look of Perkins in the periods where he was good. Written a piece on him today, which focuses a little bit more actually on what's going on between Leeds and West Ham and the process of trying to arrange a fee for a player who West Ham were very, very unhappy to lose and Leeds were delighted to sign, and a player who's been scoring for fun in the under-21s. Mateo Joseph, I thought, was very impressive as well. Lively, good movement. Positioning pretty unpredictable, made him quite difficult to pick up. And JB, without being brilliant, I thought fought a good fight in the centre of midfield. And it does seem to me that if you are investing in this talent ID scheme, which Leeds are, and as much as we criticise Leeds quite a lot recently for various things, I think talent ID is one thing they do particularly well. And I do like a lot of the kids who they've picked up. I think if you are going to invest in that level, it's important that you do actually play these players from time to time. And it felt, even though Leeds lost last night, it felt like the right occasion to me.
What did you make of Gelhardt and what do we know of his injury so far?
We didn't get much of an update on his injury. It looked like a twist to his ankle or something along those lines. We'll see Marsh tomorrow. And the reason we're recording pre-press conference this week is just because the short amount of time between the presser tomorrow and the Spurs game means that you wouldn't have a lot of time to soak this podcast up. I would say that Gelhardt is trying to find his mojo somewhat at the moment. I think whereas I was impressed with Joseph and Perkins and I thought JB had a good night and Helder as well at the back, actually really good game, it was more difficult for Gelhardt. He doesn't seem to have found his flow or to have found those little touches of magic that he had last season. I think that's partly because he hasn't been used very much and it hasn't been a season that's really lent itself to that. But yeah, I think I sat last night and I looked at him and I thought that. I looked at Harrison and thought that there's a definite dip of form going on there. There's another player who needs to find a little bit extra and a little bit of something from somewhere. But as far as the game went and as far as the team went, I thought they were competitive. I thought they were in the tie. I thought they could have won it. I did think they could have won it. But in the end, Wolves turned the screw when it mattered, last sort of 10 minutes. Came up with a very good goal. We'll probably feel like they deserve to go through.
Anybody else stand out for you then, apart from Perkins, maybe?
As I say, Joseph, I thought, was good on the left. Potentially even more of a threat when he came central in the second half and then moved up front after Gilhart came off the pitch. But I did think Helder was decent at the back. It wasn't a weak Wolves team. It was changed. There were six changes, so it wasn't full strength either. But you did have, as I put it, the kind of physical muscle of Adama Traore. You had this kind of mental muscle of Ruben Neves, extremely good midfielder. So it was a good examination for them. And I thought Helder did a good job at the back. I do like the look of him. I think he is a centre-back rather than a left-back. I think if he gets his way and plays where he prefers to play, then he'll be a centre-back moving further down the line. But between him and Creswell, it makes me feel that defensively, they've got some good options coming through at a young level.
Ahead of the Barnsley game, Angus Kinnear wrote in his programme notes, "In the last 2 years, our laser focus on confounding the odds to retain our Premier League status meant the two cups couldn't receive the priority we all wanted to give them. This season is different, as we have the tactical foundations and the squad depth to mount campaigns on three fronts. Victor and I have a particularly poor track record in the cups, having witnessed numerous early exits, including humiliations at Crawley and Newport. We therefore share a personal desire to give supporters a cup run we can be proud of." How does that sit with what we saw last night in terms of the lineup and the result?
I actually went back through the full transcript of the interview that we did with Andrea Radrizzani in August to see whether or not he'd mentioned cup runs, because Marsh has spoken himself about the progression as he sees it with Leeds this season, next season, over a kind of sustained period of time, is to move towards winning trophies. And clearly that means going somewhere in one or other of the cup competitions. And I think, as it turned out, they were in the tie last night and they could have won it, but I don't think what was on the bench gave them a huge shot of turning the game massively when they needed it to. And it was very hard to look at the squad that was chosen and not think that the priority was Spurs at the weekend, and Marsh was very much keeping that in his mind. I remember a while back speaking to a coach who was talking about the cup competitions in England, and he was saying that the clubs who set it as a priority or a target for themselves at the start of the season, and it's quite a small percentage, are doing so because they either want to make money from it or they want to win it. And across the Premier League and the Championship, the two divisions where you're likely to get a winner, and let's be honest, Premier League more than anything else, most clubs in there realise that they don't necessarily have the depth to go particularly far, or they are likely to get done by one of your bigger clubs. And it's interesting because we did the pre-match Q&A as usual before Wolves, and somebody said in there, to use their words, "The big boys never take this seriously, so we should have a go." And then you look back through the list of winners starting last year, and it goes Liverpool, Manchester City, Manchester City, Manchester City, Manchester City, Manchester United, which is a little bit like Oxford, Cambridge and Hull, ho-ho, Manchester City, Chelsea, Manchester City. So although it's true that not all of your top sides go a huge distance in it, and there were quite a few notable exits, Tottenham last night, Liverpool going through on penalties eventually, Arsenal losing to Brighton, it does tend to be the case that in the end, power and depth of squad works. And it's funny how often the cup ties come up at a point where there are constraining factors. So your form isn't great, or injuries don't allow you to do what you want to do. And, you know, a few people said to me, well, there are no games after Saturday, you know, after Spurs, wide open space. And okay, some players will be away to the World Cup, but some aren't going to play for weeks. But it doesn't change the fact that the physical exertion and the impact of a game on a Wednesday night could have a big bearing on a game down at Spurs on a Saturday afternoon. Had it been a Tuesday night game at Wolves, perhaps it would have been slightly different. I suspect not. I think Marsh would have done that regardless. But I think for obvious reasons, he will very much have his eyes on Tottenham.
Given the lack of games now until the World Cup, do you think there was a sense maybe that he was just wanting to test out some of those players to get a look at them at a higher level, maybe with January in mind? I'm just already trying to think ahead to justifications for not buying a striker. And we can go, well, Joseph looked good.
Well, the problem is, though, on that front, that even if Joseph does look good, and even if you like the look of Perkins, and even if Nonto has made an impact, and Gilhart, you know, can play far better than he has, you have an issue with Bamford, don't you? We'll see whether or not Bamford is fit for Tottenham. It was Rennie Maric who did the press conference afterwards. I've got a great story about that, which I'll tell shortly. But he said Bamford might be fit for the weekend. I think even if Bamford is fit for the weekend, it'd be very difficult to start him, and unlikely that he would start. So at the moment, he's looking at having gone, I think I said this on Monday, calendar year without scoring by the time Leeds come back to resume his season, and almost 18 months without completing 90 minutes. So the idea of relying on him or trusting that something big is going to come from him, I think becomes less and less credible and less feasible as time goes on. It's not to say that it won't, and it's not to say that he won't suddenly find his fitness and find his touch and his finishing again. But I think it's a bit of a leap of faith to say that's definitely going to happen. And they are going to have to face up to that as time goes on, I feel. And January would seem like the point at which to do it. As far as testing the players goes, I was saying in a piece this morning, which is predominantly about Perkins, but actually just broadened out into the talent ID aspect of what Leeds are doing. A lot of these players play well in cruise mode for the 21s. And I don't mean they're in cruise mode, but they look as if it's not exerting them too much. It's not that much of a challenge. So in order to really push them, you know, you've got Perkins, who at one point was something ridiculous, like 10 goals in 13 games, just scoring every week. You've got Joseph, who's almost a goal a game. You've got JB, who does look like a Rolls Royce at that level, plays really nicely. So in order to test them, in order to push them, and Marsh has spoken about this before, you know, those who almost fall betwixt and between, not really under 21s anymore in terms of quality, but not first team players in the amount of minutes they're getting either. You've got to take advantage of these games, I think, and you have to use them. If there was one thing I was going to take issue with, it would probably be the strength of the bench last night, because there wasn't much there to dig them out when they needed it. But you have to say they were very close to penalty shootout, which I managed to jinx with 10 minutes to go.
You said you'd got rid of the jinx.
Well, the only thing is, does it count as a jinx? Because they might have lost anyway on penalties. I guess it probably does.
It was a fair shout as well, because I was watching that game and it felt like it was petering out, didn't it, at that point? It felt like both teams were kind of accepting penalties.
I heard somebody in the press box say penalties after about 20 minutes. But anyway, we didn't make it, and people were not best pleased about that.
I have to admit, at halftime, I thought this has got 0-0 written all over it. But, you know, there's always a danger, isn't there, at this level of conceding a goal. Just to say,
this is one of the weird things about the League Cup, is that you end up getting quite a lot of drama out of it in some circumstances because of the penalty shootouts. You know, I was listening to Five Live on the way home, and they were talking about how it's great value for money, the League Cup. You get penalties, you get all this drama at the end of it. But to take Newcastle Palace as an example, by all accounts, the game was utterly, utterly dreadful. So yes, you got penalty shootout at the end, but it wasn't much of a spectacle in the meantime. And I don't think it was particularly great value for money, most of it. It's just a strange competition, isn't it? It doesn't know where it's placed. It doesn't really know how to engage clubs until you get further down the line and get a proper sniff of winning it.
It's redundant, isn't it? I mean, really,
I think it is.
Yeah, I was thinking about this on the drive home back from here last night after we did the match ball, and I thought, what is the point of this competition? It's here because it was always here, but what is really the point of it now? I don't think the clubs want it, the players don't want it, fans don't really enjoy it. At best, you get a day out at Wembley if you're a Man City fan.
They've really trimmed it back over the years as well, because it used to be two legs. Every tie used to be two legs, which is crazy when you think about it. And then it was on the night, but extra time. Now it's just penalties. You think at some point they're going to say, do you both want to just do
45 minutes?
Do you both just want to do a penalty shootout?
Yeah.
And just get it over
just
and done
with. Just get it settled in an afternoon. Yeah, that would be fine. I was listening to some of the commentary on Tuesday night, the night before Leeds played, and they would switch to various grounds like Brentford, you know, so looking at a big upset here, looking at a big upset there. And part of you is there thinking, is it an upset though? Because do these clubs... are these clubs remotely bothered?
I mean, that's the thing. We sat here last night and we're like, oh, well, you know, we ended up talking about footballers in lingerie for some unknown reason.
Yeah.
But and that's kind of the kind of level of...
Same as us at Wolves, actually, yeah.
The level of care that kind of goes into that defeat. Whereas, you know, like you lose a game in the Premier League and sometimes it feels like the world's crashing down around your ears, doesn't it?
But then again, there was a Newcastle fan on the radio last night who was saying, we haven't won a trophy since 69. So if you were offering me the chance of a top four finish and qualification for the Champions League or the League Cup, which Newcastle must have a reasonable chance of winning now, given the way the competition's looking. He said, I'd take the League Cup every time.
But the caveat, and we like the word caveat on this show,
yes.
The caveat is they're saying that from the luxury of knowing they're going to be safe this season, right? Whereas you put yourself into our shoes, and we just cannot afford, if it's one versus the other, you know, and that's what I think factors into
this is what I'm saying about constraining factors is...
The team selection.
Yeah. Does your form allow you to play a really strong team? Does your squad allow you to play a really strong team? Does fitness, injuries, do they allow you to play a really strong team? And this always seems to come into play every time the League Cup comes around. So I understand what Marsh did last night. As I say, I think the bench could probably have been stronger. But I think if they get something at Spurs on Saturday, and we say this every season, don't we? If you end up getting something at Spurs, nobody cares.
Yeah, I was going to say, a point at Spurs makes it all completely justified, which shows the relative
weight, which is a shame,
weight,
because
isn't it?
I'd love to win something.
It'd
be amazing to have a day out of Wembley and actually see Leeds win
the
something.
The world's boldest man. You can do it.
Well, we had this conversation around the idea of Wigan, didn't we? One of the Q&As we did on one of our shows, somebody said, would you take the Wigan route and go down if it meant winning a trophy? Mm-hmm. And I think at the time I said, no. But do you know what? Probably.
It's just the grind inevitability of it at some point facing Man City in it and then losing anyway. You can have a good run, but you don't get to win it anyway.
This is what I'm saying.
And it's a day out.
Yeah, when you go through the past winners, it is basically your strongest and richest sides who've been dominating this for a decade. And obviously you go back a little bit further and you will pull out Swansea beating Bradford, and you know, Bradford getting to the final, which was at the time really significant. Birmingham beating Arsenal, but even then interspersed all the way through Man United, Chelsea, Tottenham. You know, it's always had this reputation of nobody really takes it seriously. But I think actually what's happened is that there are now clubs who know that they can kind of bounce through the early rounds without having to take big risks with players, because they've got really good squad depth. And then when it comes to it, and the, you know, chips are down in really difficult fixtures, semi-finals and finals, they can win it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Phil, timing. Talk to me about timing here, because we have seen...
Time is infinite.
We have seen the emergence of this story about the 49ers. It's in the Times. Martin Ziegler has written the story. Less about what's in the story, I think, because the story is, if you haven't seen it, is that the 49ers have now got the money together to do a takeover at Leeds. There's not a right lot in that story, so there's not a huge amount of substance to it. What fascinates me here is the timing. Heading into the World Cup break, heading towards the January transfer window, mounting pressure at Leeds. Could you say there's been a little bit of building discontent over the course of this season?
You reckon?
A little bit, yeah. What do you make of that, both the story and the timing?
It wasn't only Martin Ziegler's, it was Matt Lawton as well, who was working on the piece. And they're both really, really good journalists. I know both of them. I've followed Martin's stuff recently. He writes on Leeds fairly regularly and has a very good nose for this and really well connected. I mean, it's not a secret at all that the 49ers at some point are going to do this, barring something weird going on. It's been the plan for so long. But I think you can surmise, on the basis of Martin writing what he's written, that he now thinks that, yeah, 100% this will go ahead. The question that's still there, and pretty much the question that everybody's been asking, is when? You know, when will they do this? And I think what started to interest me more is why the delay, I guess, since 2021, where Leeds were at that really high point, and without any question, in terms of competitive strength and the performance of the team have gone backwards since then. There's no doubt at all. I mean, just to recap, and this goes back to the story that we did almost exactly 12 months ago. So this time last year, about the option that the 49ers Enterprises hold, which is to buy the club from Radrizzani before January 2024 for a sum. We were told at the time it would be, the agreed price was £475 million, although when we wrote it, that number was disputed somewhat. So I think to be a little bit more vague, you would say that Leeds are valued in the region of £500 million, which would certainly seem around about right. That has been on the table now for over 12 months, is still there. So yes, the question is still when, I think.
Can I just pick your brains particularly on the language there? Because you're saying it's by 2024, January 2024. Some of the other reporting on this has said that's when the option becomes active, but you say it's to do the deal by 2024.
Our understanding was that the option was there until 2024. That said, I haven't seen the paperwork for it, so I couldn't say categorically whether that's the case. I think, though, it's one of those where if the 49ers were intent on buying and Radrizzani was intent on selling, it seems unlikely to me that even if it went beyond January 2024, that there wouldn't be scope to still do the deal and sell the club. It might be that the option will persist beyond there, but I would have to look back at exactly what I wrote, but my understanding of the piece I did with David Ornstein was that the option was there until 2024, which is why we expected it to be done before that date. Interestingly, when we ran the piece originally, the kind of feeling at Elland Road was that it was probably going to come much sooner than that and probably likely to come before now. There is still, I think, a feeling that this isn't imminent as in next few weeks, but people do seem to be talking about next summer, which I guess, given that the option is January 2024, you would assume that...
It's the logical time, isn't it?
Well, common sense says that you do it off-season, doesn't it, rather than trying to do it mid-season. All the transitional aspects of senior management, executive staff, if you're going to change any of them, it is much easier to do it, as Radrizzani did when he bought Chiellino. Because if you remember Radrizzani, he invested first 50-50 with Chiellino midway through the 16-17 season, bought Chiellino out at the very end of it, went into that summer 2017 and appointed Angus Kinnear, appointed Victor Orta as director of football, changed manager, Gary Monk left, brought in Thomas Christensen. There was a huge amount of recruitment. That was down in no small way to the fact that there was the time and the space to do it. You know, there was the time and the space in order to make those decisions without having games coming at you thick and fast. And it would make far more sense to me to be doing a takeover when the season is off than it would in the middle of it. Obviously, the difference in this season is that the season is actually off for about 6 or 7 weeks, so the equivalent of kind of pre-season, but not the equivalent of a summer.
But that's what makes me wonder, Phil. Might they pull the trigger now? Just maybe if it's not the whole thing, maybe they do enough to flip it over past the 50% mark and therefore become majority owners. And then it gives them a bit of something going into January. Because, I mean, you can either back me up or deny this, Michael, but it feels like the club is in almost like a form of stasis at the minute. We're in a holding pattern until this takeover happens. And the split of shares, from what I gather, is it's 52.2% that Radrizzani holds through Greenfield Investments. And the others are split between the two investment vehicles that the 49ers put together, plus a third investment fund, Football Investment Fund, which holds 6.5%. And the two 49ers ones are just over 20. So it's basically a 52-48 split, those famous numbers again. But doesn't it feel like being so close to the threshold that we're just almost waiting now, particularly as we saw a zero net spend in the summer?
I think it does feel like there's maybe not anyone quite taking responsibility for it, because it always feels a bit like you can go, well, we're not the only people in charge of this. But then it means, I suppose, it misdirects the attention of fans a little bit, because it very much been people shouting at Victor Orta and Radrizzani and Kinnear at the moment. But they can kind of go, well, we're not the only people. And if people are investing money, you've obviously got to invest in equal amounts. Otherwise, you end up essentially subsidising the other shareholder, don't you? So I think from that point of view, it does complicate things a bit. And I mean, maybe the transfer investment would have been exactly the same had it been entirely owned by the 49ers. But with the fact there hasn't particularly been any, I know the club would dispute that, but on the face of it, there hasn't been much transfer investment across the summer.
Yeah, as fans see it. I mean, but then again, they do point you to the 3 years, don't they? Like,
I think that was the point they were trying to make, was that they'd spent over two seasons without selling anybody or without recouping any money from the transfer market. And this was the first summer where they'd sold Rafinha and sold Phillips. So they pulled in money to finance deals. That was almost what Mike was saying there, was almost the gist of the piece that I did on Victor Orta on Tuesday, which was this age-old debate about, is he a good director of football? Is he a bad director of football? Is his influence positive more often than not, or is it negative more often than not? And as I went on with it and as I thought about it more, I did kind of feel that there are kind of historic arguments about Orta that go back to things like John Kevin Augustine on the negative side, the appointment of Bielsa on the very positive side. But where they're at the moment, and I think the frustration you're seeing in him, or the kind of annoyance, anger you're seeing in him, feels to me because, like you said, there is a sense of stasis at the moment. And I think it doesn't help that the crowd are there seeing issues with the team and form and everything else, and knowing that in the background, there is actually the promise of change. You know, there are a lot of clubs and a lot of fan bases who will sit saying, we need new ownership, we need a change at the top, without actually any avenue to do that. You know, who is going to come and buy your club? Who's going to invest in it? Who is going to make it considerably better?
I remember those years.
Don't you just, though? No, you do. That's the thing. Whereas there is actually an answer to that here, which is that the 49ers enterprises want to buy it. They've got this option in place. It's been there for a while now. They've been creeping up and up and up with the shareholding towards 50%. And I think more and more you start to ask yourself, why the delay? You know, why would you not want to get in on this at a point where the club are kind of at the height as they were 18 months ago? The club are still in good shape. There's a lot good about the club. But obviously the stadium hasn't developed, and that needs to happen in order for, you know, capacity to increase, but also the value of the club to increase and all those different aspects. But I don't think any of us have ever doubted that they will do it. It's just that as time has gone on, you've thought to yourself, hasn't the point passed at which you would say, let's get on with this?
But we've been back and forth on this a few times, you and I, Phil, haven't we? Like off the show, saying, why haven't they done it yet? Why haven't they pulled the trigger? And I keep circling back to the same two points, that there's either a lack of money being in place, which this story would then say has now changed, or...
Well, there has been a lot of talk about, in the States, the 49ers looking for finance investment to make sure that they had, because it wasn't a secret, and it's not a secret, that when they bought in the really substantial investment after promotion, it wasn't just the San Francisco 49ers who were involved in that. It was essentially a consortium of various people who put money in order to make it happen. And I think one of the things that will be asked, as and when they do buy the club, will be, who is involved in this? Where does the money come from? Who are the influential people, individuals, organizations behind
all this? Are you saying you want LL Cool J as our chairman?
Why not? Why not? just for some pure banter years, as they say. But I think it will be a legitimate question. You know, the money, because football clubs are hideously expensive to run these days, and people will have seen the story about Liverpool being put up for sale. Ornstein broke that last week. FSG in the market now to find a buyer for Liverpool. And I guess the valuation that's been put on them varies depending on what you read. But people seem to think it's in the region of about £4 billion, which compared to Liverpool, I think Leeds at around about half a billion would seem about right. You know, seems about, that's a lot of money.
Football clubs don't make money though, do they? Generally speaking, not that sort of money.
Well, the question about FSG has been, are they giving up on this because the Super League doesn't seem to be going anywhere, and that avenue to go down and, you know, change your revenue streams and I guess to make money, to make a massive profit. I mean, they should make a lot of cash out of selling Liverpool, but is the scope there to do it? And certainly at Leeds, I mean, I go back to the accounts, the most recent set of accounts that Leeds have released, where the profit was negligible to the point of, when you start talking about Premier League finances, to the point of being irrelevant. You know, it was a tiny, tiny amount of cash that would buy you very little. It would, not fair to say very little, it would buy you a nonto in the transfer market, but that's not the sort of deal that you need to be doing regularly in order to be a really competitive side. So it is incredibly expensive. So that, yeah, I think when the 49ers do come in, that will be one of the things that's discussed, is who's the money?
We should get the person who's doing Man City's commercial deals in, because they seem to be doing really well on that.
Yeah, they make a
stuff.
Lot, don't they?
Do really well on
from
it.
From their commercial partners, yeah.
Just going back to the interview we did with Radrizzani in August, and we asked him about this. 49ers Enterprises, what is happening with them? What's the plan? And he said, At the moment, there's no need to change. I'm happy. I really dream to bring this club to play in Europe, and then I'm happy to leave. So still some work to do here. We're very good friends with the 49ers. They're a solid partner. They let you work in peace and they're supportive. They became very good friends. In this moment, there is nothing under discussion. They have, as you know, an option to take a majority in 2024. Maybe before or that moment, something will be discussed. At this moment, we are super happy.
Well, that brings me back to the thought that I didn't quite close out there, which was, have the 49ers either been looking for money or is there an agreement in place with Radrizzani to maybe give him, let's say, 3 years in the Premier League? That's what he's asked for, which is why this has been in this holding pattern, I guess, is the phrase I'm looking for. Or is it a combination of the two, maybe? I don't know.
You can read into those quotes that Radrizzani isn't ready to go, or certainly wasn't ready to go when we spoke to him in August. The kind of vision that they've always had, and Arthur is the same with this, that they want to see Leeds play in Europe before they think about moving on.
Do you think that's beyond them, though? Do you think that this ownership in the form of Radrizzani, with the January window looming, do you think they've just about run out of road?
I do wonder if it's beyond them, European qualification. And I don't mean that as a criticism, because I don't think European qualification is an easy thing to aim for at all. I think even more difficult is sustained European qualification. You can dip in from time to time, but I think dipping in once and then backpedaling further down the table is no good to anybody. Yes, you get a few European trips and yes, you get a little bit of an adventure like that. But if you're being strategic about it and if you're really wanting to develop and grow, then European football should be what you're chasing time and time again. I think you have to remember that they are only 2 years back in the Premier League, kicking on to 2.5 years. So there is definitely a time frame in which it's unfair to demand moving towards Europe. But given how expensive it is now in the transfer market, the expenditure that's needed to compete, I do wonder whether they're able to do that. And I think the fact that the 49ers are in the wings and the fact that the 49ers are there want to take this on and will have ideas of expansion and growth tells you that it does need that at some point. Nobody's really denying that, I don't think.
Is it fair of fans to demand that we not be so close to relegation at this stage? Or does that need more time? Is it just the nature of the Premier League that it's a 20-team league, it's very, very tight. You have anybody who's from about eighth downwards who's still in that mix. Does it just need a bit of time there? Or are we right to say we shouldn't be down there?
One of the things I was saying in the piece about Orta is that on the one hand, I don't think Leeds have always been or are particularly good at accepting fallibility or accepting mistakes when they're made. I also think some of us, me included, are probably not particularly fair always at remembering that it is a properly ruthless division and that actually it doesn't take a huge number of mistakes, and every club makes mistakes, it doesn't take a huge number to get you into trouble, you know, or to pile on top of you. I think you can accept being in the mix if you feel as if everything is kind of in order. I think when you have frustrations like the centre forward that didn't come in the summer, the absence of a left back and so on, you start to see ways in which a club could have covered the back or could have, mitigated the risk of getting sucked into the bottom three. But, I mean, all of a sudden, you look at the table and there are clubs who are in trouble. You know, Leeds are not out, by any means out of the woods after the two wins that they've had. But I should say as well that somebody made the point on Twitter that, you know, when we were chatting on Monday about the Bournemouth game, I was saying there's still things to be concerned about in that game, despite the result. But if you flip that on its head, you can say that there have been games like Arsenal, for example, where they've played extremely well and taken nothing. So it's kind of the same in reverse. But they're not the only club by any stretch who are under the cosh. I mean, take Wolves as an example. You know, they are not in good shape at all. Forest spent a lot of money, signed a lot of players during the summer, not in good shape, stuck at the bottom of the table. I think if you can hold around mid-table for a duration of, I don't know, maybe three, four seasons after you come up, that seems to me to be totally acceptable. I know it's not romantic and I know it's not massively ambitious, but I think if you're sensible and you don't have a huge injection of cash from somewhere, then you have to be realistic about what it takes to make incremental steps in a league like this.
I think that's possibly where the board have slipped up, though, because 1 year in they were talking about expanding the stadium and about European football, and so when there's no sign of it 18 months later, everyone's going, but you said.
It's a fair point. Yeah, absolutely.
Does the same carry over into transfers, Phil, as well? Like, I was just about to say similar, but regards to my own frustrations about what they failed to do in the summer, when Angus Kinnear wrote that, you know, about having two international number nines, one of which still isn't fit up to Christmas, and one that we're still not sure about.
Is Rodrigo in the Spain squad? Speaking of which?
The Spain squad gets announced Friday, tomorrow. Oh. So we'll find out about Llorente. We'll talk a little bit about World Cup squads in part three.
I was just going to say, sorry, yeah, just to go back to that thought, was in terms of recruiting a striker and a left back, and I know they got Firpo, who was probably in the price bracket that I'm talking about at 13 million, but the failure like to get the striker when it was kind of staring you in the face, and then you get the finger wagging attitude from the board in various different forms, be it Twitter or program notes or shouting into a camera lens in the West Stand. That's what I think puts people's noses out of joint a little bit. We saw the evidence for what's happened way back then. And I think the frustration is like, so they're going for like Cody Gakpo or whoever at 30, 40 million pounds, Charles de Ketelaere, which is fair enough. But to then not have a contingency or say, do you know what? Actually, there may be, if we're smart about this, if we use our street smarts, get some other players in who can fill these gaps. And even, you know, not having warm bodies. Well, sometimes you need warm bodies. You know, you look at like someone like who's recruited at Palace, for example, Elise, they got for what, 10 million or under or something like that. And I know we spoke about him on this show, didn't we? Some time before. Little things like that where you can be a bit smarter in the market and you don't always have to go for these Victor shoot for the moon signings.
We may have covered this ground before, I think, more than once. No, the shoot for the moon signings look great on paper and are fantastic if you make them happen, although de Ketelaere is not having a happy time at AC Milan from what I can gather.
Yeah, but he's a broken toy now, which means Victor will like him even more.
Well, we were having a joke this morning, weren't we, about RDP, yeah. And the mighty Sid Lowe saying, let me just see if I can dig this up. Something on the lines of, RDP confuses me because he just doesn't look very good. he should be good and he just doesn't.
Yeah, I find RDP disconcerting, should be good, but just isn't.
Yes. So there we go.
You take his name out of your mouth.
I'm sorry about that, yeah. But de Ketelaere is not having a good time at Milan. I think you're right. I don't think everything needs to be spectacular. Although, Rad Rezani did describe de Ketelaere as the kind of icing on the cake signing. And if you're being fair and you look at the other transfers that they did during the summer, they were kind of sensible, weren't they? You know, Adams, yeah, Aronson, yeah. Christensen, yeah. They weren't in the outlandish bracket of that's a wild punt or you're unlikely to get that one done, rocker. They were realistic and I think could be the skeleton of a good team, competitive team. The one thing I always try to remind myself is that you cannot expect clubs to have unlimited amounts of money. There's always going to be limitations for all but a few. And I've never ever gone along with the argument that if they don't have enough money to do X, then they should pass it over to somebody who has enough money, who has Y amount of cash and therefore can do it. Because those people don't always exist. What you do have at Leeds is you have a takeover kind of there waiting to happen, which is, to all intents and purposes, already agreed at a price and terms and everything else. What that would actually mean from the 49ers is, again, something that needs to be asked and something that needs to be explained. You know, how will they differ? How would they differ? What would the transfer policy look like under them in comparison to what it's looked like under Rad Rezani? But I don't object to the fact that Leeds are dealing in the bracket of, you know, £10 million for Rocker, £25 million or thereabouts for Aronson, Adams, that sort of thing. I think that's where I expect them to be dealing. If they can push the boat out and get Gakpo or de Ketelaere, as we all thought de Ketelaere might be, then absolutely great. But you've got to pay the money. You know, you've just got to go big on them. You can't sort of do the dance and then get caught out at the end. And I don't know, maybe there is a lesson in those that actually it's more advantageous at this point to shoot a little bit lower and make sure that you're covered.
Just go steady.
I was going to say, you said about icing on the cake. There's a bit of thinking, well,
where's the cake?
Are we putting the icing before the cake here? Because like a left back, a striker, these are positions that need filling. And both Gakpo and de Ketelaere, neither of them were a position we necessarily needed, I don't think. Neither are out-and-out strikers.
Well, it's perfect when you come and look at the links to Ben Brereton-Diaz. I've got to a point now where I'm saying, just like, sign him. Just sign him. If you can get him now, 6 months before the end of his contract, for however much it costs, get him, because he is perhaps not just a warm body, but a decent body to have in there as well. You know, he might not work out, but he'll work out to an extent. And he probably will be fitter than not fit, hopefully.
Sometimes you do need to cut your cloth a little bit. I think that's definitely true. I mean, the whole author debate interests me because it goes much broader than him, doesn't it? It's much wider. It's more about ownership and it's about regime as opposed to an individual person in it. And I always remind myself that Otto is, although he's massively influential employee at Leeds, he is still an employee. You know, I was saying in the piece that I wrote, every owner should be told, because criticism always goes up, doesn't it? You have a go at the players, but then that criticism moves towards the head coach because in the end, he's coaching them, he's in charge. But then with the head coach, the criticism moves up by director of football or chief executive or whoever. But then at the top, you've got your chairman or your owner. And I was saying in this piece, every owner who comes in should be told, ultimately, it's your fault. Ultimately, in the end, you will be the one who takes the criticism because beyond you, there's nowhere left to go apart from God or whichever deity you believe in. But it is the chairman who's at the top of it. And the thing about this regime at Leeds is they have taken the club from a position that was just meandering championship side to such a better standing than they were in. And I think the frustration as people see it is that Bielsa petered out as it did, that they've gone from that, you know, really, really high standpoint of 2021 to a dip now. You know, it was flying really high at that point and it has dipped. But I think there needs to be a fair amount of nuance in the debate where you can say, it has been good this. You know, there have been really, really good aspects of this, but the 49ers are clearly in the wings and perhaps a change would not be a bad thing.
I was thinking about this. I've been reflecting on it, you know, and I've asked the question before about, are we as fans too entitled? Do we ask for too much from our clubs? I wonder, is there something intangible at Leeds that maybe the 49ers might be able to do differently? Do you agree about this? Like the sense of calm and control and kind of nobility, almost, if you like? Because I think that's one of the things that, one of the intangible things anyway, that Leeds fans would like our club to do is behave like a grown-up, weighty Premier League club. And I think at times people feel like, you know, you look at the badge scenario, you look at Jean-Kevin Augustin, and you see a club that doesn't necessarily do that sometimes at its worst. At its best, it's great. But when it's at its worst, people see those things.
I find this with football writing, really. When it's going badly wrong at Leeds, everybody hates everyone, me included. I mean, they hate me as opposed to me hating everybody. I'm not generally a hateful person.
Some of the things you've said off air, Phil.
Although I can make exceptions. And when everything's going really well, everybody's happy as it comes. Every player is great. You give players so much more time and space and patience and everything else. And I think that probably applies to somebody like Otto, for example. I mean, this is definitely the era of extreme emotions in football. So perhaps he's absolutely made for it because he is an extremely emotional guy.
I think.
But when you're away at Derby, people are quite enjoying, aren't they, the amusement of him with his binoculars and everything else. But when it's different and when it's more negative and when it's the agitation that we saw on Saturday, it rubs people up the wrong way. Although I did see plenty of people say, if you're going to dish it out and he has a pop back, then, you know, you've kind of got to be prepared to take that. I think to say what I said on Monday, it just felt like an odd occasion to do it because, yeah, it was a properly rousing hellfire win, that one. But it was not as if it was a 6-0 rout. You know, there'd been some pretty desperate moments during that game. And it just felt like the day to kind of take the win, enjoy the drama and the kind of buzz of the second half and just let it lie. Yeah. You know, and I think I get the sense that the apology that he put out was pretty much saying that himself.
Yeah. And maybe we need to all just take a few steps back from the constant sense of existential terror that seems to surround Leeds United, particularly in the Premier League. Because we know what relegation entails, and there is terror built into the idea of another 16 years out of this division, even if we don't like what goes on in the division itself.
I think football more than ever, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, is definitely in the routine now of every game being an exercise of who needs taken out and lynched, you know, who is sensational and the next coming of Jesus. You know, it is that kind of swerve between, I guess, extremes where sometimes it's quite difficult to sit in the middle and say, it was all right, that. Yeah, it was fine. Let's all go home. Yeah, you know, you were saying last week about players at Man City, just really good. Just really good. Like, just really need them too much more than that. And I mean, that's a bit facetious because football's so complex and there's so many complexities to it. But it just feels like an emotional place at the moment, Leeds, and has done for quite a while. And I felt that looking at Otter and seeing what was going on at the weekend, that absolutely no reason to disbelieve what he's saying about, you know, intimidation and abuse, because it has happened before, and I'm absolutely certain that that will be true. And you just cannot tolerate that, because it takes football down a really slippery slope if you do, whatever the reasons for it. You know, it is a sport, and it is a pastime, and you do have to see it through that lens from time to time. But I think what was happening on Saturday was just, again, a kind of expression of the underlying discontent or the discord that there is between the boardroom and the crowd, which has kind of been growing for a while.
Hi, I'm Adam Crafton, and I'm the host of The Athletic's new documentary series, Away From Home. We've been following Ukrainian football team Shakhtar Donetsk through the Champions League group stage. They've had to play their home games in Poland following Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
The first bomb, I'll never forget.
In this series, we're going to take you inside Shakhtar. Travelling with them across Europe as they set out on their Champions League odyssey.
It's not only about football now, it's about the show that we are fighting.
I'll be speaking to those in Ukraine itself, hearing stories about how the war has affected them.
My wife's father, he died.
They killed him.
Subscribe now to Away From Home to follow the whole story.
One to go before the World Cup then, Phil. We head to White Hart Lane-ish on Saturday. Just a reminder, as I said at the start of the show, that this show will be taking a break until just before Christmas, unless something happens in the intervening period. Have Leeds got a chance here? Everyone now, because we're riding off the back of increasing body of evidence that we can turn it on against so-called big teams, is there an opportunity here for Leeds to get something from Spurs?
Not only that, I think Tottenham, but certainly the fan base down there, have got themselves into the mindset of there's something to be had from them. On this tour of strange teams at the moment, we discussed this about Bournemouth and the way in which their stats are kind of contrary to their league position in a big, big way. And Tottenham are going through this bizarre streak of starting almost impossibly badly time and time again, giving themselves too much to do, dropping points all over the place, or desperately having to claw them back as they did against Bournemouth, just as Leeds did against Bournemouth. And there does seem to be a fair amount of discontent about the way Conte's setting up, about whether he's ambitious enough with his lineups, whether he's aggressive enough with his lineups. I think the general feeling is that he isn't, or he could be more so, and should be, given some of the players they've got, because they do have a really good squad, Spurs. There's some quality players available to him. But they are fourth. You know, they are fourth in the table. It's just that so often when I hear them discussed, it seems to revolve around the subject of nobody's quite sure how.
Just teetering on perpetual crisis.
We're fourth, but nobody's quite sure how. In the same way as, I suppose, you could maybe say Leeds are 12th, and how has that happened, given where they were? So the odds are going to favour Tottenham, and people will, I think, look for a home win this weekend. But I do feel like there could be something in it for Leeds, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? I think we could be 3-0 up or 3-0 down at half-time in this game. It could go any one of all the ways.
Yeah, and this weekend is going to be weird because it's the last one before the World Cup. So,
do you think it'll affect the players a bit, even subconsciously?
Well, Marsh has asked us last week, I think it was, and he said he'd seen nothing to suggest that that was the case. I mean, the call-ups have been starting to come. So just to recap where we are at the moment, Tyler Adams, Brendan Aaronson, both in the USA squad, as expected. Rasmus Christensen is in the Denmark squad again, as expected. Ilan Mili hasn't made the France squad. Magnan at AC Milan injury has obviously taken him, but Mandanda, who's wildly experienced, is going as one of the three goalkeepers. Robin Koch hasn't made the Germany squad. He's been left out of that, which I think will be a big disappointment for him. We're still waiting for Llorente and Rodrigo to be announced. That's Friday. Also Holland for Strike, that is Friday as well. Matthias Klik is due to be the Poland squad should be this afternoon. A couple of journalists in Poland, I was reading a piece by TVP Sport in which they were saying they don't think Klik will be included. That was their gut feeling, and seems to be the gut feeling of the press over there, but we'll find out when that comes. So obviously there are people with the tournament to come. There are people who don't have it to come. But this, you would think, is the weekend where if there were players out there who were feeling slightly flaky about the thought of being injured and missing Qatar, then this would be the weekend where they kind of hold something back. And what was quite interesting, Spurs beaten in the League Cup last night by Nottingham Forest, Harry Kane was substituted quite early in the game, and Conte said afterwards, he's really tired. He's really tired.
Good.
Well, that's a shame, isn't it?
He should rest him for the weekend.
Just rest everybody.
So,
yeah.
Son is out injured.
Yes.
But he's going to be in the career squad regardless, said the career manager, because he's too important to them. So he said, even if he's injured, he's going to be in. Mm. Kane should have a rest.
Yes.
And they should just all take it very, very easy.
Just play the kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do a bench like Marsh's bench at Wolves. Yeah, why not? Why not? I was saying on our Q&A, we need to retire the phrase free hit, I think, because free hit is completely impossible to define. But I feel as if for the first time in a long time, Leeds can probably go and play with a little bit of freedom on Saturday. Certainly a little bit less pressure than was there before, say, Anfield, you know, when it really was absolutely at its height.
Well, we have redefined free hit a little bit, haven't we, this season? People are now viewing it as, well, actually, we turned it on against Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool. Why not?
On a free hit, you actually can make contact with the ball, yeah. I think is the thing, whereas not just get spanked 6-0, 7-0 or whatever, which is what it came to be.
It's coming from a position of, we're absolutely crap, so we might as well just go give this a go and see what it turns up. But actually, we're in these games.
There were loads of free hits towards the end of Bielsa's first Premier League season, loads, because Leeds were safe and everything else. So, you know, as much as I don't think he understands the concept of free hit at all, that was not in his mindset as a coach. There were lots of games that weren't going to make any difference to Leeds unless it was about qualifying for Europe or something like that. I think even with this game, you might say, well, it's Spurs, so it's difficult and they're fourth and they've got a better squad and this, that and the other. But if you lose at Tottenham, then the scope is there for the table to close up again, and you start the day going, that's a free hit. And by the end of it, you're saying, not really liking the look of how the table is. I think if they were to take anything from this, say a point, Leeds would be absolutely delighted with the league position come the World Cup. And I don't mean delighted vis-a-vis how they would have hoped this season would have gone at the outset, but vis-a-vis where they were.
How unfolded. Absolutely. And do you know what? They'd be right to be proud, I think, well.
I think they would.
I think we in part two there, we spoke at length about maybe some of the mistakes we think they've made. But there is also credit due as well to both the manager and the people above him, because, say, you know, if the failure tends to travel up the pyramid there, so the success should too as well. And I know owners and directors and stuff don't get maybe the love they feel they're entitled to receive for stuff like this, and maybe that's part of what Red Rezani's like, then credit should be delivered, shouldn't they?
I hear it said a lot that they were lucky to fall across Bielsa. You know, they were lucky that they had Bielsa. But
that was deliberate, wasn't it?
It was deliberate, and it was a deliberate pick on Arteta's part. And more to the point, I would ask the question of who else was going out to recruit Bielsa at that point. He'd gone from Lille. It had gone really badly at Lille. That doesn't mean that he wasn't a kind of outstanding or highly, highly influential coach, because he absolutely was. But that was a specific choice. And then beyond that, you have to create the framework round about it to make it work in the way that it did. So fundamentally, massively, massively down to the coach, but also down to the club being able to function in a way where it all worked for him, and it all happened up until the point where obviously it kind of fell apart. And yeah, you're right. I mean, two things here. The first is that the players quite clearly have not abandoned Marsh. I mean, you could not accuse them of that at all. Between Anfield and the Bournemouth game, you've kind of seen their motivation and their attitude. And you've also seen the way in which the younger players, who he's kind of had to rest on quite heavily, you know, Somerville in particular, but Nonto against Bournemouth, the way in which they've actually come into it. And rather than, as you've seen with kids in the past, thinking circumstances are dreadful here and bloody hell, the atmosphere's awful, you know, thinking, get in there, make it happen, do your thing. And that's what I liked about the kids at Wolves last night, was they all seemed to be playing their game, you know, playing as if they were at Thorpe Arts for the 21s. I was watching Perkins early on, and he just looked as at ease, I thought, as he had been in his better performances for the academy. So yeah, it's totally, totally unfair to dig away through bad form, and then when the form turns, to pretend that it's down to something else entirely, or that that no credit is due. I don't think it changes the fact that there are issues with this team, and I don't think it changes some of the concerns I have about this team and the way they're set up. But as I say, know, if they were to come away from Tottenham with a point and reach the World Cup on 16 from 14 games and be 3-4 points ahead of the bottom three, chuffed to bits with that.
Yeah, the route to that destination doesn't really matter, does it, when it comes to the shake-up? You just look at the table and the points. Let me throw a scenario at you now, both of you. 2 weeks today, England face the United States. Thanksgiving weekend, big occasion in the States. It's going to be a big World Cup occasion. We go to Saturday, Tottenham Stadium. Tyler Adams, full-blooded challenge. Harry Kane. Harry Kane limps off.
Smash.
Tyler Adams becomes villain ahead of the World Cup in all the papers.
It's fine by me.
I have to be honest. I think if you're going to be a villain, Leeds is a pretty good place to be a villain. Come have a go. see what happens. Well, that I guess will be the test on Saturday, though, won't it? Who is going into those challenges? Who's pulling out of them? Who's trying to get off the pitch early? Who's looking after themselves? Perhaps nobody. You know, perhaps nobody will be doing that. And, you know, I don't really get the impression that Kane is that sort. I mean, I was watching him in Tottenham's last Champions League game and his elbows were all shredded and bleeding and everything else. He's a committed guy. I don't, you know, and seems, I think Tottenham as a club seemed to matter to him fairly, you know, and I know.
Especially when he was trying to get to Manchester City.
I know he's very nearly out the door to Manchester City, but he's given them some service, you know, and he's a player who quite easily could have moved on. You know, you didn't see Haaland hanging around at Dortmund forever, did you? You know, he's off to City and doing what players tend to do. So yeah, but you're right. People not be best impressed if Adams two foots him and it's, no, it's the old prayer mat for the metatarsal routine.
On our strikers, assuming Bamford and Gelhardt are not fit, which I kind of have my doubts about both, who's first off the bench then, do you think, now, given what we saw of both Perkins and Joseph yesterday?
It's a great question. Great question. Because I was saying in the piece that I wrote today that to this point, it's been, you're thinking Bamford plays at nine. If everybody's fit, Bamford plays at nine. You could throw Rodrigo in there, but you're really looking at Gelhardt and saying, you know, if it's not Bamford, you'd like to see Gelhardt giving a go. Although there's the argument about whether or not Gelhardt is actually better in a slightly more withdrawn role rather than up front. But now you have Joseph, who I think has got seven goals in eight games for the academy. You've got Perkins, who was on that ridiculous run where just like every time he turned up, he was scoring. Again, with Perkins, can play a more withdrawn role. So where he's actually best, I think, is probably still a moot point. But you've got Nonto. Somerville's clearly a winger, so you're going to play him out wide. But you do have a bit of choice there, actually. It's the irony of what's going on with senior, experienced first-team strikers is that they're kind of spoiled for choice. Academy level, they've got loads of options who all look really good. And I have to say, you know, again, to sort of balance out the criticism that there's been, I do think the talent ID at Leeds is very decent.
How much did we pay for Joseph?
Joseph was around about £1 million, I think. And likewise for Gelhardt, thereabouts or not necessarily so much. Perkins has been the
TBC.
The article I wrote kind of led off on the fact that the transfer, which should feasibly have become messy. And okay, it was messy to negotiate, but should have become messy, or was most likely to become messy, was Rafinha to Barcelona. It was the only place he was going to go. Barcelona were a nightmare to deal with. And right up to the end, there was this nagging doubt about, do Barcelona have the money? You know, are they going to pay for him? And from what I'm told, they've been good as gold, Barcelona. You know, the penalty clause that was in there became a contingency and nothing more. And they stuck to their obligations. And weirdly enough, the deal that's become complicated or has caused, you know, most friction has been far less high profile. Perkins from West Ham. You'll remember the statement that West Ham put out when he left, saying that he'd rejected a contract with them and they were annoyed because they thought another club had been trying to entice Perkins to release himself from his scholarship down at West Ham. He subsequently goes to Leeds. Leeds and West Ham are arguing about the cash.
That was naughty of that other club that tried to do that. I'm glad they came to us.
Leeds obviously deny any wrongdoing. And they think that Perkins, on the basis of first team experience, wage at West Ham, you know, similar tribunal awards or fees agreed for comparable academy players, that he's worth in the region of about 750 grand, something like that, six figures. West Ham would like much more for him. So obviously there's this argument going on, and the feeling from the beginning was always that this will end up getting decided at tribunal. But again, to look at him and look at what he's doing in the academy, if they were to get him for 750 grand, good signing.
Mm. One final thought on Spurs then, before we head off. Dare we make a prediction about this?
Nah. Had I still been on a roll with this jinx fest, then I would have said absolutely. But I'm going there with a bit of optimism, I think.
Dangerous, isn't it,
optimism.
Though?
It is. It is.
Is it folly, though? Well, we'll know, won't we, by the time Saturday tea time comes around?
We will do. I think they need a result, though, don't they? I don't think it's going to do much for the mood if they get beaten on Saturday. The same for everybody, isn't it? There is a long, long stretch coming up and a lot of time to stew if it's...
Imagine three wins on the bounce, though. Imagine that in the Premier League.
Especially, I always expected them to beat Bournemouth, although not at 3-1 down. Didn't think that was coming. But I really did not anticipate anything coming back from Anfield. And I thought Tottenham might be a more difficult game than it's currently looking. I mean, I suspect you'll get a feel very early on down in London for how that game's going to go. And you said, could see us being 3-0 up at halftime, could see us being 3-0 down. I think you'll know soon enough. Yeah. You know, I think it'll become clear pretty rapidly how the balance of that's going to be. I mean, it was Conte's first game and Leeds were down there last year. It was a really, really good match. And I think Spurs probably edged it on the strength of how they played in the second half. But given that Leeds were out of form and things weren't going too well and the injuries were absolutely ludicrous. I mean, I think that was the first time that Archie Gray had shown up, you know, at the age of about 7. And I thought Leeds were unlucky not to get anything from it. I did think it was a good game where they could have taken something. So, play well and who knows?
Who knows indeed. Phil, one more show to go then before the World Cup break. We're having 5 weeks off unless something happens at Elland Road and we'll be back just before Christmas. But before we head off from this episode, we have a snippet from The Athletic's brand new documentary series. It's called Away From Home. They've been granted access, all areas, access to Shakhtar Donetsk during their Champions League campaign. Obviously, all their normal lives completely turned on their head by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. True, it is remarkable. It is such a good listen. And if you want to hear a bit of that, stick about. Hear a snippet now, and you can find the first three episodes of that in your podcast app. Just search for Away From Home. Enjoy this teaser.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, of course. You can ask a question. I try to answer.
Sure. So I suppose to begin, can you explain the past couple of days, how you are, and also if your family is okay, first of all?
Yes, in the morning of 24th of the February, we woke up after the sounds of bombs. And went to basement.
This is the captain of Ukrainian football club Shakhtar Donetsk. His name is Taras Stepanenko, and he's one of the most famous footballers in his country. He was born before the collapse of the Soviet Union, he played over 70 times for Ukraine, and he's been with his club since 2010. I called him as war broke out to learn what was happening firsthand.
Multiple attacks on cities right across the country. The foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, has just tweeted that the country is under full-scale invasion by Russia.
I have a wife and three sons, one 7 years, one 8, and one 4.
Okay. What do you tell them?
My wife scared so much, and we started to read news. But my sons, they don't understand clearly what happened. Now I think they're scared too.
Stepanenko's life changed, like so many other Ukrainians did when Russia invaded the country in early 2022. But 6 months on, unlike most men his age, he's fortunate enough to do his normal job again, to play football, and to play in the Champions League, where the best teams from across the continent face off to be crowned kings of Europe. For Ukraine, football is more than a sport now. It's a unifier. It's a statement to the world that they are strong, and Shakhtar Donetsk is the embodiment of that sentiment.
We are showing to all the world that we are still alive.
Nothing cannot kill us. We are in the war for 2014. It will be difficult to play, but we must play.
Unfortunately, we are thinking just about Ukraine now. And if this fucking bastard from Russia think that we will stop to play because of that, we will not stop to play. We'll play and we will win.
For The Athletic, I'm Adam Crafton. Over the course of this series, I'll be tracking Shakhtar's unique football journey as they navigate their way through football's toughest contest, all whilst there's a brutal war raging on their doorstep, forcing them out of their own country.
You didn't sleep, you cannot sleep. 3 days. 3 days without sleep.
I'm proud that I'm part of this team, of this club. And today we can be proud because this victory is for Ukrainian people, for Ukrainian citizens.
It's not only about football now, it's about to show that we are fighting, that we are still alive.
This is Away From Home, Episode 1, We Believe in Miracles.
The Phil Hay Show.